Ladies and gentlemen, madams, messieurs, welcome to a new 2-Bit Podcast. We are joined again by Thomas 77, the illustrious, the brilliant, the genius, revisionist history expert, to talk about the Ukraine-Russia conflict, as I'm calling it. I think conflict is apropos because it's going to be far more reaching than just the current war or special operations or whatever you're going to call it. Thomas, please introduce yourself to the crowd. I mean, I doubt anyone who's been listening to our content doesn't know who you are, but just in case, let everyone know who you are, and then we'll go from there.
I'm Thomas. You may know me in various platforms as Thomas 777. I write about many things that upset a lot of people, but that a dedicated, in my opinion, elite minority finds to be quite useful. That's all I got.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I've titled this a dissident sit rep because we might do a series out of this on some level. Kind of what we with the Ukraine-Russia conflict, what we've said for since we've covered this since the start of the whole thing. Of course, anyone who knows can look at my last name. I've Ukrainian heritage, third generation born in Canada, so I've identified more or less with my Ukrainian side and been following the events since 1989, essentially. And I've considered myself a Ukrainian nationalist for whatever that's worth for quite a long time now. One of the things that we've said continuously is that as a Ukrainian nationalist, the one thing I want is Ukrainians to, you know, not get mass murdered. That seems to be the more moral situation here, and I never saw the conflict ending in any way that it's other than what it's currently at. So one of the things I want to do with you, Thomas, is cut through a lot of the bullshit that we keep hearing. I've sent you some links with Colonel Douglas McGregor, who I found probably the best in all of this. And I say the best because there's other people out there who are doing really good work on this, but he brings this sort of adult presence to the conversation, at least in the mainstream, where he's kind of cutting through all this and saying, look, this is the situation, this is the problem, and if you don't start dealing with reality, then just millions of more people are going to get killed for literally no reason. So I'll let you go, Thomas, on this, but let's first start with the Ukrainian Nazis thing, because that seems to be the sizzle to this beef. Where people kind of glom onto it, both right-wing and left-wing people are glomming onto this whole Ukrainian Nazi thing. And, you know, I've constantly said that, you know, one of the things I'm looking forward to heaven is never having to hear a World War II reference ever again. In fact, if I do hear a World War II reference in heaven, I'll know I'm actually in the other place. So why don't you start with that? Ukrainian Nazis or even Satanists, yeah, where do you want to go with that? Like, because I know you have some.
Ultimately, the way to look at Ukraine, Ukraine is never going to be some kind of independent actor in geostrategic terms. Okay, that's clear. All right, it's either going to be pivoted towards Moscow or towards NATO. All right, Ukrainian National Socialism, in and of itself, is not illegitimate or anything, but the only way it would have any meaningful it would be a meaningful quantity is if it was acting on behalf of a European imperative, territorial, political, or militarily. And what underlies this conflict really is America's continuing war on Europe, and specifically Germany, okay, thus the American terrorist attack on European infrastructure and the Nord Stream pipeline. So if you're a Ukrainian National Socialist, you're literally waging war on Europe. You're committing genocide against your own race in the form of other Eastern Slavs, and you're doing so on orders of a Zionist Jewish gangster. I mean, it sounds like I'm being funny, but I'm not being funny. I mean, that's literally what it is. You know, I view these guys as like these ISIS types who, you know, were jailbirds, had no interest in Islam. But, you know, upon getting cut loose amidst the anarchy of Iraq's implosion, realized, well, if I click up with ISIS, I can take scalps of Shia, and I don't like them anyway. And oh, I can corral like 3 or 4 slave wives too, and that's great. You know, it's the ideology of the school shooter. Okay, I mean, it's not. And finally, I mean, there's absolutely no possibility that Ukraine could prevail militarily. There's no constellation of factors where that happens. But even if that did happen, it's not like NATO. It's not like NATO would let Ukraine become this, you know, national socialist state. Like Ukraine would become a woke state immediately, a social engineering regime to banish, you know, Orthodox Christianity, to banish racial consciousness, you know, to dilute the ethnic integrity of the population because it's too white. I mean, all so basically, even if they realized NSIG, they'd be committing suicide by doing that. Okay, so there's absolutely no legitimacy to the Azov position, you know, like none at all. And I mean, I know that people, for some reason, I get like death threats from people for saying that. It's like, well, I don't know, man. Like, you're literally fighting on behalf of a Zionist gangster who has said straight up he is a Zionist, and that Ukraine needs to open itself up to, you know, these social engineering paradigms, you know, that such as exist in occupied Europe. I mean, it makes you feel good to like murder your own people for the sake of wokeism, but wear a swastika while you're doing it. I mean, if people are literally that like infantile and primitive, I mean, I don't know what to say about that, but it's got nothing to do with historical national socialism or anything of a meaningful nature politically. You know, it's some pretext for organized violence of an antisocial sort.
It would make more sense to me if they're trying to pull power from the symbology, right? If they're using the symbol to, in some ways, almost spiritually gain power from it. I think it's the same thing you're starting to see with a lot of Satanist stuff coming out of Ukraine too, mostly by the same people who are, you know, lightning symbols on their helmets, and also are promoting the destruction of the church. Two major things that I found really unnerving, really, that is coming out of it as someone who considers himself Ukrainian, for better or for worse, is the sort of the conflict almost with their own Slavic roots. You know, you see that a lot with Polish, and the Polish have always, this is a constant thing with Poles going back to, you know, what, of the 13th century, where they've always been wanting to be more Latin than Slavic. But there seems to be this conflict almost with their own Slavic identity. And that's something that, you know, I think Stalin was very good at in some ways. One of the ways he kept it together wasn't just through strongmanning, but also through that almost pan-Slavic identity that he leaned very, very heavily into, especially in the lead up to World War II and post-war. And that seems to be a major conflict, as well as a conflict with the church. And it's, again, shooting yourself in the foot. The only reason we have Ukrainian language still, you know, quick history lesson for anyone, like Catherine the Great annexed the Ukraine, you know, over 250 years ago. One of the things they did when she did that was to basically make the Ukrainian language, culture, etc., illegal, in terms of an amalgamation attempt to make them sort of a pan-Russian kind of state. One of the reasons why the Ukrainian church and culture and language still survives today is because of the church. They took it underground, they exported to other places, but basically the church kept it alive. And since Ukrainian, you know, liberation, let's say in 1991, they were the ones who came out of the lavras, came out of the caves, and reproduced almost, reproduced the Ukraine as a viable state in terms of culture, if nothing else. So by attacking the church and trying to outlaw the church, you're also just destroying any idea of Ukraine. I said this originally when they started using the word Kyiv instead of Kiev. Mm-hmm. It's like you're creating that's a separate parallel future. Like that's not attached to history. It's always been Kiev. It always will be Kiev. But now you're calling it Kyiv. What the fuck is that?
Well, it's like, also, I mean, I just wanted to insinuate in the case of Poland, I mean, yeah, I agree with you. There's something of a contrivance. Extreme Polish chauvinism is based on a series of contrivances, but they are deeply integrated into the Roman church culturally. You know, and it's not like a Bosnia situation either. Like, despite there being superficial similarities, you know, between Serbs, Croats, and Bosniaks, they're very different people, you know, in terms of sect, in terms of cultural practices, in terms of prime symbols. That's not the case with Ukraine. Like, Ukrainians are literally slaughtering their own people on behalf, again, of an outwardly Zionist regime. Like, that doesn't, there's not really a precedent for that. You know, like, it doesn't, there, it's, and it's quite literally insane. You know, like, there's not, you know, and people, yeah, and this kind of butchering of language, like, that clown, Zelensky, he's like, he spells his name in this tortured way that phonetically spells like Volodomir or something, because he's in some like infantile way he's trying to insist that, you know, he doesn't share a name with Mr. Putin, I guess. I mean, that's something a child would do, but I, you know, everything about this is, I mean, I don't want to say it's childlike because that makes it sound insipid and harmless, and it's anything but it's incredible that rational, at least nominally rational people could think this way, you know? And I mean, it just doesn't track with anything, you know? And also too, I might add, you know, Putin, if anything, because he's got no military experience. I mean, I realize that in the Soviet system, KGB men were considered to be a branch of the military. But frankly, one of the reasons Russia's in this mess is because Putin has tolerated provocation after provocation after provocation after provocation, and finally only, you know, gave the order for escalation when the enemy was literally on Russia's border. But the Russians, you know, if Ukraine had simply declared nominal neutrality, they could pursue whatever kind of regime they wanted, as is the case in Chechnya, as is the case in Kazakhstan. There was literally no reason for this war. There was nothing to be gained from it. I mean, aside from the fact that there was no possibility of military victory, you know, despite what CNN says, Russia has no interest in occupying Ukraine for no reason. You know, Russia doesn't care what the Ukrainians do within their own dominion, so long as it's denied NATO as a basing platform. You know, and like I said, if people say, well, that's nonsense, Putin's this brute, he's just saying that. Well, I mean, what about Chechnya? What about Kazakhstan? What possible gain would the Russian, what possible interest would the Russians have in just occupying Ukraine? That would literally gain nothing. You know, there's absolutely no imperative that would suggest that that's advantageous. Go ahead, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No.
Well, just because what I'm always trying to figure out is I know there's some kind of lineage or heritage for these Azov nationalist types back to World War II, something. But other than what you just described, like, how does this strange marriage work between the regime and these fighters? And what is their, like, is there any sensible motivation for them to be working together at all?
Like, I don't think so, no. I mean, like I said, it'd be one thing if, let's say, Europe was not under American occupation still, and let's say that Germany and Russia were at loggerheads, okay, just in some counterfactual scenario, and the Germans were feeding all kinds of men material and intangible force multipliers, you know, into Ukraine, you know, to kind of beef up a Ukrainian nationalist element with the assurance that, hey, you're going to be integrated basically into like the German sphere of influence militarily, politically, economically. And that's what was the case in World War II. Okay. You also had Cossacks who clicked up with the Third Reich because, I mean, but the main impetus there was anti-communism. Okay. Right. That made perfect sense. Today, it's the same as these ISIS guys, but without the possibility of victory. They're actually, like, I can see how ISIS thought that they, like, NC was realizable. I think that level of violence that they were prone to employing in order to sustain, you know, control through fear within their operational areas of control, I think that's self-defeating because I don't think it's sustainable. But at least there was, like, a path to military victory wherein these ISIS freaks could have their Islamic paradise or whatever.
Right.
Like in Ukraine, they're literally just like slaughtering their own people again on behalf of an openly Zionist regime on Washington's payroll. Yeah. You know, and again, even if final victory was realized, Ukraine would rapidly be socially engineered out of existence as a distinct and discrete cultural form and race. And if these guys, if their whole raison d'etre is like preservation of their race in biological terms, well, they're eradicating their own mentioned material every day that they train their guns on other Slavs. You know, exactly. I mean, for Zelensky, I mean, that's
so that's no, what I don't sense. Get. Like, it's not only is victory impossible, what's the shared vision? Like, what does victory look like to these guys? How could it possibly be the same thing when they're good loggerheads on every issue that I could?
All I can tell you
is just being bribed. Like, how is he getting them for the fun of war?
When my before my Telegram channel got unceremoniously banned, I think I'm the only person ever banned from Telegram, other than somebody who's like promoting, you know, like sale of narcotics or child pornography or something. Every day before it got nuked, it was rendered unusable by Azov freaks who are spamming my channel with snuff footage of them killing Russian POWs, like really disgusting pornography, like death threats. I mean, that seems to be like the level on which these people exist. Mm-hmm. I mean, what did that Ukrainian diplomat say to Elon Musk? He would just said, fuck off. Like, right. His people are like a bunch of simians. They just like grunted people, you know, like I live around Chicago has a huge Ukrainian population. A designated community area that I live by is literally called Ukrainian Village. I'm around Ukrainian people. They don't act like that. I mean, I don't know who these people are. I think part of it is at the level of general officers. Yeah, I think it's money and clout. You know, Zelensky, these billions of dollars that are just, you know, splashed out in Zelensky like he's some gangster rapper or something, and America's his record label. I think he lines the pockets of these generals, and you know it's that simple. And they figure, you know, if they stack up enough assets, they figure like when it all goes down, you know, they can just bounce to, you know, America or Miami or, you know, Germany or whatever, and kind of live large or get some kind of like fake, you know, mercenary job with, you know, the Department of Defense or something. But at the level of grunts, I think some of these guys are probably, you know, are probably intimidated and violently gang pressed into service. I think some of them are just crazy. You know, I mean, I don't know though. I don't live there.
Right. Well, yeah, I think a Ukrainian propaganda recruitment video. And basically it was like, you get to fly those little Amazon drones and blow shit up.
Like, you get to play video games.
Yeah. That was the big draw.
Yeah. I think the enemy of corruption is competency, or vice versa. So I think what we're seeing, and we're seeing this, I think, in the West too, if there's any bitter white pill to be had about the collapse of the system as we know it, is that the corruption has gotten to such a point that it's actually forcing competency out of it. Like, you can't have a highly competent person. Let's put it this way. You can't have most people who are highly corrupt aren't highly competent. It's those two mindsets, I don't think, exist in the same person. And so usually when you have a high level of competency, the last thing you want is corruption. You're like, wait a minute, like, this can't stand. It's not saying that everyone who's competent is also moralistically pure, but at some point they're going to balk at things. And I think that, you know, they instill Biden because he's the most corrupt of all the corrupt people in that den of vipers. It's like, here's your biggest figurehead.
He's literally a moron who's been a punchline for 40 years. And yeah, it's clear that you'd probably get him to eat a pile of dog shit, like, if you set the price point high enough.
Exactly. Right. And I think that's what you're seeing in the Ukraine as well. Just to go to your point, it's like, why do you have all these grunting morons who are making military decisions that are beyond the pale of stupid? Like, Bakhmut, someone needs, maybe you can speak on this, Thomas, because I've been trying to figure out exactly what made Bakhmut Bakhmut. Like, I understand, and Colonel McGregor, of course, has been really good on this, is saying the Russians set a trap to lure them in to basically meat grind out the entire Ukrainian army, which seems to have been the case and seems to have worked incredibly well. It also seems to have been the greatest folly, because now Russia is, by any metric, the most powerful military in the world based on experience. And I started thinking about this when I was listening to you, your series with Pete on the Cold War, specifically about, you touched on World War II with the Russians versus the Germans, and how one of the biggest fallacies the Germans made was basically giving the Russians massive amounts of experience, where the Russians decided that, you know, the best thing we can do is to, we can lose territory, but gain experience until the point where our troops are now so battle hardened and experienced that now we're just going to take territory like crazy. And we're seeing the exact same thing happen in Ukraine, almost to a note. So maybe we can touch on that. I know that's throwing a lot at you, but.
No, it's fine. I mean, the Bakhmut thing, I think, I'm not a military man, but I think I know something about how things play out politically that have a military dimension. Why Bakhmut became, Bakhmut's not strategically significant. It became so because Zelensky declared that this is the line in the sand. You know, okay, so, you know, to your point, you know, the Russians, they allowed Kiev to rapidly reconstitute and reinforce Bakhmut before assaulting it. And I mean, the Russia's objective has always been to kill the Ukrainian army. They don't care about outside of Odessa and outside of, you know, the key ports that they, you know, require access to in order to project power and basic capacities. There's absolutely no reason to occupy anywhere else in Ukraine. But what Zelensky's mindset is, you know, every few months, Zelensky declares that, you know, Ukraine is reconstituting for some mass offensive. And I believe that's part of the scam. I mean, first of all, people like Biden, like literally is like a drooling idiot. I don't think he's particularly involved in decision making, but he's, to your point, that degree of corruption generates a kind of absurd incompetence. I think that so long as Zelensky can claim that he's still in the game militarily, you know, and he can point to these kinds of fake, like, you know, garrison holdouts, supposedly from where, you know, the tide is going to be turned after some, like, you know, after some Stalingrad type defense. I believe that's part of selling the package to these abject morons in Washington. And these military types know that's ridiculous. Like, they don't care because this is all make work anyway, and they're getting rich off of dead Ukrainians. I think that's what it is. But even, I mean, the thing to understand, and McGregor, to your point, I know some people don't like him, but I've read his stuff for years. He wrote some of the best stuff on the National Volksarmee and Warsaw Pact capabilities in general, you know, because most of his career was spent, or like the kind of core of his career was spent with Black Horse on the inter-German border. But the key thing to understand is even if Zelensky and Kiev were making more like reasoned decisions, there is no constellation of factors there's no possible scenario where Ukraine prevails over Russia. Russia would never allow Ukraine to become a NATO basing platform because it's at decapitation range. Thus, for Ukraine to win, they would literally have to destroy the Russian army, destroy its ability to reconstitute, and politically break the back of Moscow and its will to wage war. That basically means Ukraine would have to push the Russian army out, essentially march to Moscow, and be able to threaten the Russian regime with devastation were it to attempt to reconstitute forces. That's absurd beyond belief. There is no possible scenario where that could happen. So pursuing this war against Russia, it's war for its own sake. I think on some level, it's let's bleed Russia. But to your point, all that does is, you know, Russia went from having a skeleton crew force of, you know, half, like just under 1 million men or something. You know, now I think they've got something like 1.2 million men under arms. They've got a battle-hardened core, you know, like they're now like how many kilometers farther west than they were prior to February 2022. So, I mean, the entire thing is beyond foolish, but I don't think people are thinking that far ahead in terms of Washington war planners. Again, some of them are literally morons, but some of them they're getting rich, so they don't care. You know, McGregor made the point that America has 44 like four-star generals and admirals. You want to know how many four-stars there were during World War II? 7. Like, this is literally like a make-work like con that the military is running. You know, it's and that's why they immediately like went woke, you know, like when everybody was pretending like, you know, they were some sort of stalwart holdout of the right wing or something. After the Cold War, I'm not talking about the enlisted level, I'm talking about the career officer level. After the Cold War, it became this goofy make work regime for idiots who want to like wear uniforms and pretend they're on Star Trek and freaks and fetishists and like Zionist cruds. Like, who the hell wants to pursue a military career at officer level like after 1989? Like, why? You know, it's lost its raison d'etre. Unless like your notion is what Madeleine Albright said, and it's like it's kind of like the Trotsky, the neo-Trotskyist spear point of like spreading wokeism by violence. I mean, that's what the military's for today. So I mean, if that's your jive, like, you know, consider the kinds of characters it's attracting at, again, at the level of general officers. I'm not talking about enlisted people.
So I remember hearing a while back that basically all of this, and I've no idea, maybe you can speak to the veracity of this claim or not, but I had heard that this was an exercise really in logistics for China. How do we get the equipment there? Can we be battle ready?
And I mean, I hear
that possible?
I mean, people really, really want China to emerge as some sort of neo-Soviet Union in strategic terms. Yeah. I think some of this is subconscious because it would make the strategic paradigm make more sense to them because they're still locked in 20th century thinking. Just like it's absurd when people claim like what's going to happen over Taiwan. Like if you tried to stop, first of all, China would never invade Taiwan. If America tried to intervene in Taiwan against China, they'd be at war with the Taiwanese and the Chinese people. I mean, it's absurd to suggest that would happen. I agree with Mearsheimer in that it's crazy that America's basically, you know, for the last 40 years has essentially been providing China with the capabilities and the technological know-how to fully modernize its military apparatus. Like, yes, that's a crazy thing to do. At the same time, I can't see a scenario wherein like America fights a major conventional war with China. I just don't see how that develops. Now, I don't want to spin off on too much of like a deep tangent. I do believe by mid-century, you're going to see a genuine power political struggle, you know, waged by proxy in part, but also waged by, you know, forces in being and limited capacities. You're going to see a real power political conflict paradigm emerging in Central Asia, with the major players being the United States, Turkey, the Russian Federation, and China. And America is going to be contra China most often in that paradigm. So, like, yeah, I can see American servicemen under arms trading hostile fire with the Chinese. This is all going to be very much below board. It's not going to make the evening news or its equivalent, or it's not going to make, you know, like the AP news cycle. But that's going to be absolutely like one of the primary sort of national security challenges by mid-century. But it's not. It's not going to escalate to the point of, you know, a massive collision of conventional forces that require these, you know, operational logistics at scale. So no, I don't accept that.
Yeah. But is it possible? Sorry, because that's my opinion too. Just from my basic knowledge of the Chinese, is that it relies on the fundamental assumption that that's how they would fight, and I don't think maybe Americans are dumb enough to think that, and they're doing this because I'm just trying to figure out, other than the money, what's the motivation?
It's ethno-sectarian. The dominant ethnic group in American policymaking circles hates Russia. They hate Russia. They hate Russia with every fiber of their being. This can't be overstated. And like, people don't understand that because they're like, oh, but Putin and Israel had, you know, cordial relations. That's not the way politics works. You're not just like always, you know, at loggerheads with people in some flagrant and hysterical way, even if they're your blood ancestral enemies. Like the degree to which these people hate the Russians, like, can't be overstated. I mean, it just can't. Okay. Like, it's literally like bred into them, you know, and that's always been their, I mean, this is what underlay like the late Cold War, you know, and the reason why, the reason why the Soviet Union was literally at war with Israel periodically. I mean, it wasn't just geostrategic considerations. Those considerations came about owing to a lot of the features of the sensibilities I'm talking about. But that's what it is. You know, you've got people who've got an absolute tribal hatred of Russia and want to see it destroyed. And then there's also people where they're a minority, but that doesn't motivate them. But they're like, you know, Russia's, in their view, Russia's white, so it's too white, it's too Christian, it persecutes like homosexual people. You know, it's this retrograde kind of like quasi-fascist regime, so it just has to be annihilated. It's got to be socially engineered out of existence because it's offensive to them that it exists. It's that simple.
Yeah, one of the things that comes up, I think they've almost transferred the energy from the Hun to the Slav. I mean, obviously those two things are almost interchangeable in a lot of Western minds. People fail to see the distinction. I mean, in Canada, for example, in World War I, they set up concentration camps essentially for the Hun, which included a lot of Ukrainians, like basically all the Ukrainians that they brought over to extend the prairies at the turn of the 20th century, then got locked up in open air concentration camps. Oh
yeah, America did the same thing in places like yeah. Crystal City. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so there seems to be almost this sort of ancestral displacement of that sort of eternal hatred for the Hun that's now just become an eternal hatred for the Slav. I don't quite understand it in terms of, I'm trying to even think symbolically, like where would that come from? Oftentimes the only thing I can reach for is religion. Like it seems to be it's almost a religious kind of sectarian hatred.
If you're talking about like these Slavs in like flyover country, you decide they absolutely hate Putin and hate Russia. Like, you know, not talking about like Zionist types. Like they're just provincial idiots. Like most like liberals and most provincial people on this planet, and they hate other people who just talk funny or aren't like them. I mean, they mask it in this kind of bizarre, trashy, you know, faux cosmopolitan veneer, but they're just bigoted morons. You know, so they like Russians are different than them, and you know, they have strange ways of talking, and they've, you know, they've got Byzantine ways of worship, so they're bad people. It's that simple. But in elite corridors, it's what I said. It's truly a blood based, like absolute racial hatred of Russians by people who view Moscow as the source of all evil things. And they literally still tell their kids like horror stories about like the Cossacks like raped your grandma to death and things. Like, I'm not being funny like that. Like funny as that might sound to people, like it's literally like their sensibility.
Right. And I mean, I've heard it said a lot, you know, plenty of times that it's sort of a holdover from the Cold War, but it seems to be greater in depth and breadth than that.
Oh, 100%. Well, look what Reagan, I mean, I'm not some huge Reaganite. I mean, Reagan was a brilliant politician, and he was probably, I think he was arguably like the most lucid man ever to hold the Oval Office in terms of his public speaking ability. It's really flawless. Mm. Like it's incredible, but I'm not some sort of like Reagan fanboy. But part of the brilliance of Reaganite kind of propaganda narratives, like look at Reagan's speech about, he had the speech where he's talking about, you know, like John and Mary and their counterparts in the Soviet Union, like Ivan and Vesna or something. And he was like, you know, the Russian people are like us, they're Christian people. And, you know, they're enslaved by an evil regime. And, you know, we must never like be prejudiced against the Russians as a people. I mean, some of that might sound corny, but that's actually the way most like middle Americans felt. They didn't like hate Russians, you know, like in, the people at the top, like, especially in the Team B coterie, I mean, certain they did. I mean, they were exactly the types we were talking about a moment ago. But what's different today is, yeah, like what you said, it's like this, it's this like bigoted intolerance. But it's the same thing these trashy woke types, like they hate Muslims for similar reasons. You know, like they claim they don't because they'll find some lady who's like a self-identified like lesbian feminist who's like, oh, I'm a Muslim. But obviously, right, like, that's ridiculous. Like actual Muslim people, like they wanted them to be destroyed for like being like unwoke, and they talk funny and they look scary.
We're seeing that right now in Canada because the Muslims and Christians are protesting together against 100%. this pronouns stuff in schools, and the liberals turn on in a second.
Yeah, this is a tangent, but there's an audio out there of a high school teacher, I think in Edmonton or somewhere abouts there, who was admonishing the Muslim students in her class for not taking part in gay pride, whatever have you. And she said, you know, when it was Ramadan celebrations, the pro Skittles people observed your religious event. Now you need to give back. If you're not participating in this, then you're not Canadian and you should get out.
Well, it's also offensive too. It's offensive in two ways. It's like you can't just observe Ramadan. It's like you like the Oakland A's or like you like the freaking Raiders. You know, like it's not like a brand or like something you celebrate like Halloween. You know, like if you're not Muslim, you're not celebrating Ramadan. That's highly, highly offensive.
Right.
That, but that's the way, like I said, they're provincial fucking losers, man. They're these dumb hicks who think dress up their prejudices and tolerance because they're that fucking stupid.
No, sorry. It's perfect. It's the perfect mask off because I believe she even said go back to your country if you're not going to be like us.
You talk funny and you don't like me. You don't like the fact that we lock it up the ass. Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, you and your thing. So I'm going to call Pride Month Gay Ramadan though.
Yeah, I respect your Ramadan stuff. Respect my ass sex stuff.
It fits because then they're all about the pork, right? It's like the gay Ramadan is like.
In America, there's there's kind of a toxic class hostility. I made the point of people, these highfalutin people. I'm like, these aren't highfalutin people, man. They're like hillbilly idiots. You know, I'm like, wokeism is like, it's brand loyal consumers or white trash. You know, like, it's like people, like, actually cultured people don't go in for that shit. It's people like this fucking stupid cunt teacher. Like, I celebrate your Ramadan.
Yeah. The majority of white trash people are like marginally Protestant, at least.
That's what I'm saying. I'm not like trashing most poor people. Most poor people don't buy into that kind of shit. But those who do, it's a cringe, freaking underclass thing to accept that shit. Like nobody who's actually worldly views the world that way. I guess that was my point.
Thomas, let's get to the actual conflict at hand, because I mean, one of the things that I've been pointing to, and if you said you've been listening to some of our content about this, one of the things I keep telling people to the best way to cut through the propaganda, and it's propaganda on both sides. I'm more sympathetic to Putin, and I believe that the only future Ukraine has as a, let's say, as a country or as an identity or whatever you want to call it, will be under the umbrella of the Russian Republic. And certainly as someone who's been has a long time bigotry towards Russians and certainly Putin, it's been a very bitter pill for me to swallow, but it's the only way I can see forward. I mean, what we're seeing. So to cut through the propaganda on both sides, I just tell people to go look at the map and see which side is advancing and what side isn't. Now, obviously the Russians have given up positions on the Dnieper quite a bit, but maybe you can tell the listeners give a bit of more of a sit rep from what you see about where the military is at the moment, and what you kind of expect to see going forward in the next few months.
I mean, well, again, the thing to consider is this: other than literally a handful of key territorial objectives that are essential, for Russia to project power. In terms of port access, but in more localized terms, aside from a handful of key loci that are essential, to sustain operations at scale in theater, Russia's not interested in grabbing territory, and frankly, it's not the way modern warfare works. Russia's winning so long as it's killing the Ukrainian army, and what that equates to in brass tacks terms is a burn ratio that Ukraine can't sustain. And even if there was kind of parity of attrition, which there's not, it's strongly in Russia's favor by, I believe, between about Moscow claims it's 7-1, it's probably more 4-1, but that's not sustainable. So the Ukrainian army is going to cease to exist long before Russia's operational capability is exhausted. So I mean, Russia's been winning this conflict from day one. Also, what people don't understand is that, again, Putin doesn't favor military solutions for all kinds of reasons. The Russian army, first of all, was not prepared for a major war in February 2022. But also, obviously, Putin's notion was the Russian-speaking population, or the people identify as ethnically Russian in the Donbass, were at risk of being ethnically cleansed. Okay, The Russians were not going to let that happen. A small force intervened in the Donbass to make clear that this was the Russian line in the sand. And any normal regime, if there was a normal regime in Kiev, that would have opened the door to negotiations. Kiev from there went utterly berserk and said that they're going to fight Russia to the last man, which is a rare case of total irrationality in power political affairs.
Because I had heard, I'd heard that early on there were negotiations, and it was the UK that stepped in and said, don't come to the table. You got to fight this. Is that true?
Probably. Well, I mean, look at the Minsk agreement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like Merkel disclosed, the Minsk agreement was nothing but an opportunity. Like, the Ukrainians wanted to buy time to reconstitute because they believed, and they were sold a bill of goods by NATO, I believe, that, you know, they needed to reconstitute forces to put themselves in a better position to assault, you know, Russian-speaking populations in Donbass. This whole mm-hmm. thing was bad faith from the beginning. Again, it's a rare case of... I mean, the terms aggressive or defensive war are basically meaningless in most contexts. This is a rare case, literally a rare case of total irrationality in power political affairs, as well as a 100% bad faith, you know, sensibility in the mind of one of the key combatants and who literally conspired to pursue war for its own sake. Like, the policy of NATO is war at all costs. Right. The, you know, and to sabotage any effort to prevent war at all costs. That's not legitimate. It's also totally irrational. But you're not dealing with rational people. You're dealing with insane Zionists and, you know, like drooling morons like Biden and you know, war profiteers who, you know, look at the manufacture of corpses as a way to profit, and, you know, and other sickos and like literal, like, you know, like literal just Jewish mafiosi like Zelensky. I mean, these are the people you're dealing with. They're ghouls. Right.
So Jay, just following on that, where you said that Putin doesn't like military solutions. My question is there a military solution? Like, what is Putin's goal? Where can he? You know, like I say, I have a hard time understanding what the shared vision is between Zelensky and the Azovs. But what is the vision for Putin? Where, at what point can Russia say, okay, we've achieved something that's either sustainable?
Well, it has totally annihilated Ukraine's ability to make war. Because Ukraine because there's an irrational regime in Ukraine. You just have to keep on smashing them until they understand that, you know, they're not going to be available as a basing platform to NATO. Russia will negotiate any time. You know, essentially, you know, Russia's going to escalate violence against Ukrainian forces in being and essential infrastructure to sustain those forces in being until Ukraine will come to the table. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, when Russia talks about denazification of Ukraine, they're talking about annihilating the Ukrainian army. So that's non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. They're going to do that regardless. But if Ukraine still refuses to negotiate when they can no longer reconstitute, Russia is probably going to practice some kind of scorched earth. That doesn't mean they're going to go in like Genghis Khan and, like, you know, with rapine and kill everybody. But it's going to be pretty bad. I mean, it's bad. It couldn't get much worse. But I mean, that's, you know. Like I said, if you're dealing with a truly irrational adversary, it's, well, I mean, it's the same thing with the Third Reich in the UK. Like, when the UK, after Dunkirk, you know, the Berlin was proceeding against the UK, you know, in according to traditional Westphalian paradigm. It's like, okay, you were defeated. What are your terms? Why exactly are you attacking us? You know, and the response was hysterical. Declarations from London that they're going to fight Germany to the last man because they're evil. I mean, what do you do in that situation? I mean, it's like if your opponent is going to keep smashing himself on you while shrieking you're evil, I mean, what do you do? I mean, you've got to smash him until he stops.
I mean, what I see in my head is basically it's a, I don't know, an older, wiser, bigger, more powerful laying down discipline.
Yeah, pretty
That's
much
what it
yeah.
is. Like, get back in line. Yeah. Stop this. You're being an idiot.
Yeah. You know? Essentially. Like, yeah. Yeah. I mean, how do you that? But that's the instances of true irrationality in hard politics, in high politics is rare, but it does happen. I mean, it's just happening now. You know, yeah. What do you do?
I mean, keep in mind, too, like if you're following the Great Reset and 2030 plans and all the rest of it, which of course the UK I think seems to be fully in bed with and progressing at an insane pace. One of the things they had earmarked was Ukraine being the new breadbasket for essentially Europe. Ukraine has some of the most fertile lands in all the world, and is already being used heavily as the agricultural zones are already there. So it makes sense to a certain degree if you're following those plans. I mean, one of the reasons they're taking, seizing a lot of land from the Dutch farmers, which was the breadbasket for Europe for forever, is that they've allocated that territory to Ukraine and Poland and a lot of the border states, and that was always the plan. So there is no plan B, which is the more shocking thing, is that I don't believe that they, ultimately, I think the powers that be would, if forced to negotiate with Russia, they would be forced to negotiate with Russia. But the other thing that's coming down the pipe that we all have to be aware of is there's a massive fertilizer issue. It's a massive fertilizer issue shortage going on globally.
That's fascinating. I didn't know it.
Yeah. So
is that a manufactured crisis though, or
it's just, they ran out. They've what's one of the active ingredients in fertilizer is,
it's the nitrogen or whatever, right?
It's a nitrogen sulfates and so that. So Russia has one of the largest depositories of fertilizer material in the world. It's one of the reasons why China's also doing a lot of work with them. But so does Ukraine. And so capturing Ukraine and capturing that agricultural zone is massively key for the elites, because they're fine with us eating bugs, but they don't want to eat the bugs. So
something too, like, what does, you know, the Kiev regime is patently irrational, and to a lesser degree, I mean, so is the UK. In the view from America, what is what really underlies this at scale strategically, this really is part of the continuing war against Germany and Europe. You know, other than help, people don't like Merkel because of some of the abominable policies she pursued as regards refugee asylum. That was pretty much out of her hands, because I mean, Merkel, like every other chancellor post Cold War, is basically powerless. What Merkel did do, though, under the auspices of green energy, which she didn't actually give a shit about, she took Germany off nuclear power and created complex interdependence with Russia through the Nord Stream pipeline. Okay. Merkel was raised in the DDR. She always knew the score. She always understood America's not Germany's friend. It's actually its mortal enemy. Okay. A German-Russian concord, that's the only path to European liberation from America. Okay. Mm-hmm. And America will never let that happen. And quite clearly, it resorts to actual terrorism to prevent that from happening. Okay, so in global terms, that's really what underlies the war against Russia. But also, again, it's the ethno-sectarian hatred of Russia and the kind of patent irrationality of in the minds of the proxies being utilized for this enterprise can't be overstated. Like, those things are very much present too. But I realize I'm more of like a Francis Yockey guy than most people today, probably. Part of that's because I'm old, but also I probably have some esoteric interests. But regardless of that, the enemy of Europe is America. Okay. America is Europe's mortal enemy. And that, like, first, last, and always, that's been the case since 1933.
So Newland was telling the truth.
Yes.
Okay.
I think we pretty much kind of summed it up. This is it's craziness. But what something that I haven't been able to keep up with at all is sort of what's going on the ground strategically. I don't know if we could sort of give a quick summary of that, like in the Ukraine, is it even based on territory anymore? Or what is the, other than we're just wiping out the army, like you had said, Thomas, like, are there strategic locales that are still in conflict? Does it even matter? Like, the lines going back and forth?
I mean,
I don't know how any of that is.
The big issue is going to be, I mean, how far NATO is going to take this. If, as Eastern Ukraine falls under complete Russian dominion in operational terms, if NATO is going to continue to pursue this irrational chorus of belligerents and start funneling men and materials through Poland to Western Ukraine, you're going to see a situation where Russian forces are within a few kilometers of the Polish border. And that would be very bad for all kinds of reasons. I mean, that's kind of the key. That's kind of the key thing to watch. You know, I mean, it's again, there's not any, there is zero path, military path, to Ukrainian victory. The Ukrainian army is not going to reconstitute, defeat the armed forces of the Russian Federation, you know, destroy their ability to reconstitute and break the political will of Moscow. Those are what would be things that be required to get Russia out of Ukraine. It is literally impossible for those things to happen.
But could NATO?
No.
Okay. Nope. NATO has no credibility unless the Joint Chiefs of Staff, unless Biden could direct the Joint Chiefs of Staff to put in a call to NATO or to put in a call to Berlin and demand that Berlin mobilize the Bundeswehr and prepare for general war with the Russian Federation, including use of nuclear and chemical weapons. Unless or until that could happen, NATO is a joke, and there's no possible way that's going to happen. So no.
Hmm. Yeah, I think it's almost like trying to separate the narrative from the let's say reality, for lack of a better word. To touch on your question, Mark, it seems like Russia's now making a strong stand along the eastern side of the Dnieper. Odessa is now in play, and I've said this since the very beginning that if Russia takes Odessa, it's over. Like, Ukraine as a state is over. It then becomes, it's just a matter of micro, it becomes a micro state, and the only question is, does Russia go all the way to Kiev? Does Kiev become a new Berlin, or something like that? I sincerely do not believe that under Putin, at least, that they will move all the way to the Polish border, because that opens them up on multiple fronts. But if taking the eastern part, let's say it's, you know, the eastern part south of the Dnieper and Odessa, it doesn't stop things, then they will. I think they'll eventually just take Kiev, which at this point, they're getting it's getting to a point now where Russia is going to be able to march freely across Ukraine. Because there's, even if the Poles, and I've heard people say this, oh, the Poles have, you know, 200,000 people they can send in. Like, it will be a bloodbath. Like, whoever you send into a land war, don't wage a land war in Asia. Right now you have literally the most powerful military unit in the world coming out of Russia, because they're battle hardened. Wagner Group is incredibly effective. All these guys are battle hardened and trained, and they have, and the war is very popular in Russia.
Yeah, well, they're motivated and seem to be somewhat enjoying themselves.
It's just how tone if these people are. I mean, I realize that regime propaganda is idiotic, but like early on, they sounded like the Iraqi information minister, like Russians are turning against, you know, the dictator Putin. It's like, do you realize you're literally fighting this war on the Russian border? I mean, like, even the most peacenik liberal or the most kind of disengaged, drunk, like Gopnik who hates Putin is going to want to you know, smash the Yankee, like, when you're literally on their border. Like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Like, there's like a total disengagement from, you know, human affairs and what actually motivates people to action, you know, politically and otherwise. But yeah, to your point, I mean, the last thing, I realize that some irresponsible rhetoric comes out of Warsaw, but I mean, the last thing Poland wants is to get sucked into some kind of quagmire fighting the Russian army. I mean, that'd be self-defeating for everybody involved. But at the same time, I mean, it would create some real quagmires, you know, of a political nature. And plus, anytime there's deployment at scale like that, I mean, things can get out of control without anybody intending for them to be so. When you've got, you know, when you got thousands of men under arms, you know, within standoff range of each other, I mean, that's incredibly dangerous. Mm-hmm. You know, why is the Cold War so dangerous? Is because you had hundreds of thousands of men armed to the teeth on the inner German border, like within visual range of each other. I mean, it's not a good thing,
right?
You know, I mean, it's kind of amazing that there wasn't that there wasn't some kind of, you know, some kind of accidental.
Yeah, I was going to say my number one fear is like unintentional escalation.
A lot of wars happen by accidents. Yeah. I mean, like it, like that. That's not just some cliche or something that, you know, like peaceniks would say, you know, in the 20th century. It's true. I got to raise up in a minute, fellows, but I want to tell you, I really, really appreciate the opportunity to participate. Like, legit, I always learn a lot from you guys, and it's always well received by the, by the viewers and listeners.
Thomas, always a pleasure, man. We'll have you on anytime. Direct people to your Substack. I'm a subscriber over there. You have Mind Phasers season 2 coming out. You have a few projects coming out, so let the people know and we'll sign.
Yeah, thanks. No, I've got a lot of irons in the fire. I mean, I'm a one-man operation. There's my crime partner, Rake, who like does all our editing, and he's a great guy, but it's just me and him. So things take time. You can find my Substack at realthomas777.substack.com. That's where the Mind Phaser podcast is. I'm launching season 2 in the next few weeks, at which point like all of season 1 will be free. You won't need to subscribe to access it. You'll just be able to click it.
As someone who's been listening, going through all your back catalog of season 1, listening to it, it's definitely worth it. It's $5 a month, guys. Like, just give Thomas $5 a month and listen to some really good content.
Yeah, eventually I'm gonna move it everything to being free. Like $5 a month, that's the cheapest I can make it and still like not absorb a loss. But I'm doing everything I can to like make the podcast free. Okay, I'm working on it. You can find me on Twitter at real_Thomas777777. I've got a new Telegram channel. It's Thomas Graham 777, like again, number 7 HMAS, Graham 777. And you can always find my content at Thomas777.com. It's a work in progress, but you can access most of my content through the website, and that's number 7 HMAS 777.com. And like I said, as in the coming weeks, it'll be more complete. But as of now, you can basically find all my YouTube content and all my Substack content through there, as well as just like random other stuff that I think is cool and I put up there. But yeah, that's all I got for now. And again, like, thank you very much, man. I always learn a lot from creating content with you guys. Like, legit, thanks. It's great.
Always
God bless you, Thomas. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. We will see you guys again soon.